Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
Hey everybody, I've got something a little embarrassing to admit. When I began the Al Franken podcast 4 years ago, I very quickly adopted my opening hook. We've got a great one today, you know, for a change. I was almost always lying because for the first 3.5 seasons, this podcast was just uniformly dreadful. And I knew I had to add for a change just to buy some credibility because people would think, well, not one of these has been good, but maybe finally this time he's got something worth listening to. And that carried me for almost 3.5 seasons. But, and I have to be honest with you here, a number of the shows started to be good. But for a change still seemed fair. I said to myself, as long as I don't do two in a row that are good, I can hold my head up and say, we got a good one today, you know, for a change, and still feel like I'm being honest with you. Then it happened. I did two good shows in a row. 2 weeks ago, I had Dahlia Lithwick on her fabulous new book, Lady Justice, now a New York Times bestseller, thanks to me. And then Sarah Silverman last week does an amazing show. These shows weren't just good. They were, well, great. Both of them. So now I'm thinking, well, at least the next one is going to be bad. And for a change, we'll still achieve its purpose, which is for you, the listeners, to think, yes, they're usually not worth listening to, but this one might be good. For a change. Well, wouldn't you know it? This one today is also great. It's getting embarrassing. I mean, even The Daily doesn't do three great shows in a row, and they have the resources of the New York Times. All I have is Peter.
That's right. It's actually kind of pathetic.
Yeah. Well, we only do one show a week.
Yeah, there's that, but it's not like I'm full time. You know, this podcast just gets a very small part of my attention.
Exactly. And yet, somehow, we've managed to string three great shows together.
Well, that's because we had Dahlia Lithwick and then Sarah Silverman, and now we have Tim Miller, who is fantastic.
Yep, that was my mistake. Tim is great. This show you're about to listen to is fabulous.
You know, I could have guessed that because I've seen him do commentary on MSNBC and he's always really, really good. And you told me his book, Why We Did It, is a really interesting look at the greed and moral turpitude of the Republican political class in D.C.
It is. And it's an amazingly honest book. Tim doesn't spare himself. Let me explain. Tim was a longtime Republican campaign operative. He worked for John McCain in 08. For Mitt Romney in 12, for Jeb Bush in 16. But once Jeb was out, Tim did everything he could in that cycle to make sure that Donald Trump did not become president. And he failed, of course. But unlike so many Republican operatives who knew that Trump was bad news, Tim remained a never Trumper. But in Why We Did It, Tim doesn't take himself off the hook. The first sentence in his book is, America never would have gotten into this mess if it weren't for me and my friends. Now, Tim is gay, and yet, after Romney lost in 2012, Tim went to work for Ken Cuccinelli, who was running for governor in Virginia.
Terrible, terrible person.
Terrible. Ken Cuccinelli is one of the most awful right-wing, anti-immigrant, homophobic politicians of our time. But Tim was a Republican political operative, and he needed a job.
Disgrace.
Yes, that Tim took that job. And yet, he is brutally honest about it. And that's why this book is great. And this show, unfortunately, our third great one in a row.
And here's the most shocking part, I think, is that even after the 2016 election, where he had gone out on a limb and very publicly done everything he could to prevent Trump from winning, he then went on to take a very well-paying job sliming Democrats and one helping prepare Scott Pruitt, the terrible, terrible anti-environmental attorney general of Oklahoma, for his confirmation to be the director of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Could not have found a worse guy for the job.
But because of that, Tim brings an understanding of how the DC Republican operatives who knew better, how those morally compromised goons went down the path of working for and enabling Trump, and why we did it is that story. And it is not just honest, it's funny. He's a funny writer. He's a funny guy and a very good guy. One of the rare people in that DC culture who will acknowledge that, yes, he did some things for the wrong reason. And who among us hasn't?
Except you, of course.
Well, thank you, Peter. Before we get to our third great one in a row, I wanted to look at a couple things in the news. Vladimir Putin. Kind of turns out that Tucker Carlson was wrong. As you remember, the day before Russia invaded Ukraine, Tucker Carlson did this rant on Democrats say we should hate Putin, but why? Has Putin called me a racist? Has he shipped all our middle-class jobs from my hometown to Russia? Has Putin tried to cancel Christmas? And Tucker's right. Putin hasn't done any of that stuff, and yet I hate Tucker. But what has Tucker done? Has he targeted civilians with cluster bombs? No. Has Tucker given medals to Russian soldiers who have committed atrocities? No. Has he hit children's hospitals and maternity wards with huge blockbuster bombs? No. Tucker hasn't done any of that, and yet I just so hate Tucker. Now, Putin is threatening to use nuclear weapons. Now, I have a theory. When you're threatening to use nuclear weapons, it's only because you think you're in a weak position. As a U.S. senator, I was privy to some classified intelligence and a logic class. So, the Oath Keepers. The Oath Keepers are on trial for a seditious conspiracy. Frankly, I think this is kind of a slam dunk case because the Oath Keeper's oath is, I will conspire to commit sedition.
That is a tough case.
Yes. Yes. Yesterday, Rhodes, he's the head of the Oath Keepers, who's on trial. His attorney told the jurors that they will see evidence that will show that the defendants, this is a quote, had no part in the bulk of the violence that occurred on January 6th. That's their defense. Oh, sure, we committed quite a lot of violence, but nowhere near the bulk of it. Did you see how many other people were committing violence? I move this case be dismissed. Okay, midterms are coming up. Get out on the doors, door knock, phone bank. Our democracy is at stake because the Republican Party has stopped participating in good faith in our democratic process. Our democracy is at stake in November. And speaking of the midterms, I'll be doing my first podcast live in front of an audience on Wednesday, November 2nd at 7:30 p.m. in New York City. It's at the City Winery in Manhattan. My special guest is David Axelrod, and we'll be talking midterms. We also have another special guest who we will announce a future date in the near future. So if you're in the New York area or have ever considered visiting New York City, November 2nd, my first podcast live in front of an audience. Okay, And now a great one, Tim Miller, a former Republican operative, now works with Bulwark, with Bill Kristol, Charlie Sykes, two other former Republicans, I think they are, who are every bit as alarmed by what has happened to the party of Lincoln and Strom Thurmond. It's a great one and a funny one, you know, for a change. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a very refreshing book. You know, I read these books, and I read Chris Christie's book, and when I saw him, I said to him, you know who comes off really well in your book? You. And and the thing is that you don't come off so great in many ways because it's like an honest book.
That's exactly what I... Thank you, Al. I was waiting for a little more praise there. But yeah, thank you. My goal in writing the book, you know, besides, you know, getting at answering the question of why people who knew better went along with Trump, was to just be completely honest about myself, not pull punches, and also not have it be homework. Those were the two main goals I had in drafting it. So I appreciate that I hit at least one of them.
I got this book about 6 weeks ago and I read it then and really enjoyed it. And it's very self-confessional. But I want to get into a lot of stuff here. I really feel that the Trump thing that we got here starting a long time ago. Yeah. And really with Gingrich and with Rush Limbaugh. That I wrote a book called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations at the time. And what I saw was that a lot of this disinformation that was dangerous. And I don't know where that's gone since then. And Newt, remember he put out this thing, Learn to Talk Like Newt? You remember that thing?
That one I must have missed, actually. I have a lot of Newt memories, but I don't remember.
Well, he put out a list of words for Republican candidates to use.
Oh, right. The lunts. Yeah.
Decay, yeah. Traitors, sick, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
To me, there's a straight line between that and Trump. And along the way, the Republican Party, with some detours and curves, just inexorably went this way, in my mind. Until we have Trump and we have Trumpism and we have something that to me is almost neo-fascist.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I tried to not write history because I'm youthful. I'm a youthful 40 and I'm not a historian. And I think other people have written that. Stuart Stevens, I don't know if he's been on the podcast, wrote
a history book. Yeah, he said it was all a lie.
Right? Yeah, and his book was really good. And it was a history book, goes back to Goldwater. And others have obviously written about this. I wanted to only talk about stuff I saw firsthand, which basically starts in the McCain. So I started the McCain-Palin campaign of 08, where I worked for Senator McCain.
Palin was a part of that, too.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, so I basically start this line. And I think that no doubt you can start this line back at Newt or Goldwater or Mark Hanna. You can start it wherever you want. But what I try to focus on is the first hand. And in 07, the book starts with the crowds that came to the McCain events. And, you know, it was this sort of proto deplorables, right? You know, there's the famous example of McCain, you know, telling the woman that President Obama is not exactly a secret Muslim. You know, you see this bifurcation in the events, actually, when Palin comes on the ticket, where her events are like these monster truck rallies. And, you know, McCain is holding these more staid events. And I think that there's something important in that, you know, and it's why I start there, in that on the one hand, we should have all seen this coming. Many of us did see this coming, who are on the McCain side of this divide, right? And we rationalized it. We rationalized collaborating with the people on the Palin side of the divide. But it's also important to just note that leadership actually does matter, right? And having somebody at the top of the ticket that was not, you know, baby birding all of these people's grievances and conspiracies that they learned about on Rush and, you know, in darker corners of the web from Rush, right back to them, like Palin wanted to do, having somebody at the top of the ticket that was, you know, at times, at least, maybe not often enough, giving them some medicine, you know, matters. And it prevents things from spiraling out of control. And so I think you can kind of have both those thoughts together in your head, right? Which is that there was always an element of this. It was inexorably growing, as you said. And at the same time, like, there were people that were acting, you know, varying degrees of more responsibly than others. And I think those of us who kind of lived through all that, we try to grapple with that. Like, what was our complicity? How was I a collaborator with this? But then also, were there good elements? You know, was there any truth to it? Was there any good elements that, you know, we can still tease back out? And so I think that's why the book is kind of half, you know, this 08 to 16 period and me looking back at the ways that I collaborated with it and the ways that I regret the growing kind of Trumpist movement. And then the second half is then what, you know, how, when people face the choice of whether to go along with something that was manifestly dangerous, manifestly bigoted and cruel, you know, why did they do what they did?
And this is really, this book is about the DC political class.
Yeah.
And about how everyone, about their complicity. And to some extent, yours, you write about. And that's why I'm saying what I liked about this book is that you are very self-critical, and I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate that you have written this book and that you're very outspoken. And you're one of the founders of Bill Kristol's, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
So the Bulwark, right? Yeah. So we had two things. Yeah. I was working with Bill. So me and Bill were working together. And I know Bill's been on the podcast and, you know, you gave him a little trouble, as I recall, which is deserved. He can take it. He's a big boy. But Bill and I worked together on what was, first it was trying to recruit someone to primary Trump in 2018, 19, 20. I think we were clear eyed that was probably going to be a fruitless endeavor, but we felt like it was worthwhile. And then
how did Bill Well do?
Bill didn't do so great. We were shooting for Larry Hogan and Adam Kinzinger and a little, you know, some bigger names. I love Bill Well, nothing against him, but it didn't turn out well. But we felt like
nice
that was
try cool. though.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's worth a try, right? It's better to be in the fight than to not.
Yes.
So we tried that. It failed. Then we started Republican Voters Against Trump, which was, you know, where we basically recruited Republicans to say in their own words why they were not going to vote for Joe Biden and ran a bunch of ads. And so that was on
why they were not going to vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah. And why they were going to vote for Joe Biden. Many of them, some of them were writing in still. And so we did that. And, you know, parallel to that, the Bulwark kind of started. And I started writing for that. Now I'm writing for the Bulwark quasi full time. And it's great. I think that we have the benefit over there of being able to be completely politically homeless now. So we have no right. choice but to just give our totally unvarnished views of all the rationalizations I talk about in the book about the political class, about how you're angling. You might have a job, you know, you want to get invited to a party. I have no chance to be a White House press secretary ever again. It's over for me. And so I can write about politics without pulling punches.
If you did, it would be a very odd person who got elected. If you're ever the White House press secretary, we're going to have a very fucking interesting president. That's well, all good. I can tell you.
All right. Well, God, I'm praying for that. But, you know,
that's good.
In the meantime, I'll just be able to write unvarnished about the state of affairs.
Okay. I there's so much I want to cover here. The DC political class is so interesting here because this is very much your book, a companion piece, to two Leibovich books.
Yeah.
Which is This Town and his newest number one, both of which are number one New York Times bestsellers. The new one is Thank You for Your Servitude. It's very much parallels his, thank you for, I mean, you know, Leibovitz, and this town is about D.C., and your book is very much about the flacks in D.C., the political class in D.C., and very much parallels what we read in this town. And then Thank You for His Servitude is about the Lindsey Grahams and the Rubios and the Cruises and everybody caving. And that's what happens with the D.C. political class in your book, which is all these people who hated Trump in the primaries end up working in one way or another for Trump.
I almost thought about titling the book What This Town Has Wrought, but I felt like that was going to be too mean to Mark, whose books were great and yeah, absolutely influential. It was
that would be an homage
to Mark. Yeah, an homage, but also a little bit, you know, it wasn't really Mark Leibovitz's fault.
he was chronicling.
Yeah, that's true. The traits, I think, that led people in the political class to go along with Trump, some of them, I think, cross boundaries, party boundaries, and were chronicled in this town. And I think some of them are very unique to the culture that has sprung up in Republican politics and the nihilism on the Republican side, which is frankly in direct contrast to the Democratic side, which, you know, in some ways does self-harm by being almost too pure and idealistic.
Well, it's nice to believe in something.
It is. No, that's great. No. Idealism is good. I just think there's always, you know, balance in all things, you know, and in politics, you want to be idealistic and, you know, you want to win in order to be able to implement your ideas. And sometimes the Democrats
absolutely agree.
Go too far on one side and the Republican. Meanwhile, they're competing against Republicans who we've come to learn are like totally nihilist. I literally believe in nothing except for owning the libs, seeing the people that they don't like be punished. And, you know, this is manifesting in Ron DeSantis's rise. But, you know, I thought Mark's book comes at it from a reported view, you know, which has a ton of benefits, right? Because a lot of these people won't talk to me anymore since I've been cast out. But mine, I think why I really tried to focus on people that I knew, you know, tries to get at the motives in a way that a reporter can't really, right? Can only speculate about it. And these are my former friends. I can put them on the couch. Some of them volunteer to be put on the couch and just understand, you know, how it is that these people who know better and who have some good traits, you know, right? There's always this temptation to be like, oh, these guys are all sociopaths or bigots. And like, there's some sociopaths and bigots working around Trump, of course.
But a lot of it is really just the D.C. political class that you write about. This is, I want that, you know, beach house. I want my career. I want, and that's very disturbing to me. I went into politics because I wanted to do good for people. And I feel that a lot of people in D.C. do it for their career, and that's kind of it, and don't really kind of care whether what they're doing is honest and whether it's productive and whether it helps people. And there just seems to be, I find that about the town extremely troubling. And it's on both sides, of course, but it's much, much worse, I think, on the Republican side. You know, you went to America Rising after the election, right?
Yeah, so I think that there are two elements. This part of it is the this town part of it is just like the structure of the town really does demand that you put on a jersey, right? And if one of the two teams' jerseys becomes completely corrupted, then it's very challenging, as we just discussed. I'm not going to be hired by a Democrat, like, to switch sides. That makes it more easy to rationalize things. And so the America Rising thing is a perfect example. So I'm at the RNC in 2012. I'd worked for John Huntsman, the most moderate candidate in the primary. I was always a moderate Republican in the general. I worked for Mitt Romney.
That's right. You did after the 12, right?
Yeah, yeah. So in Mitt Romney, then I worked for in the general while at the RNC. Then we worked on the autopsy, right? Which was arguably trying to reskin compassionate conservatism, basically. We could go deeper on that if you want. So that's where I am politically, those three things. But then for my career, it's like, okay, well, now after the campaign, I've got to go do something. And so we started America Rising, which was this group that basically the whole point of it was to, you know, do opposition research on Democrats and take down Democrats. And so you find yourself in a situation where I'm much closer politically to like a Heidi Heitkamp camp, you know, than I am to a Ted Cruz or a Ken Cuccinelli, right? But you pick a team and you don't have to do this, but if you're ambitious in politics, you want to rise up the ranks, you have to work on behalf of your team. And so I tell that story of the first campaign after we started America Rising is that Virginia governor's race, because it's the off year. So it's Ken Cuccinelli on one side, who's a homophobic anti-immigrant bigot who I loathe. I'm gay. I don't think we've covered that yet. FYI for the listeners. Terry McAuliffe on the other side. You know, maybe a little bit, a little bit on the access politics side of things, but like a totally mainstream center left corporate Democrat. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Terry would like that description, but that's basically what he is. In any other world, I'm either voting for Terry or, you know, whatever, like if I'm just a Virginia resident. But because, you know, my consulting firm and this group that we started wants to succeed and it's the first race, it's like, okay, well, you sign yourself up for Cuccinelli. And so I kind of review, like, how did I do that, right? How did I, as a gay man, go work for this homophobic bigot? And it's like, well, you know, you kind of just say, okay, this is just one. You know, you take one for the team here and hopefully it'll help the firm grow. And, you know, down the line, we'll get clients that we like better. And that kind of banal kind of careerist rationalization. And I look back on that and I say, man, is that really that different from the people that rationalize going along with Trump because they worked in Republican politics? It's like, not really. It's a little different, right? The governor of Virginia is less influential than the leader of the free world. It's, you know, one-term governor. But still, the basics of the underlying rationalizations are the same. And when I went to interview a lot of my former colleagues about why they went along with Trump, a lot of them paralleled basically how I convinced myself that it was okay to work for Ken Cuccinelli. Who's just awful, right? Yeah. So a lot of these people weren't true believers. They weren't just like these secret white nationalists just waiting for their moment. They're just careerists, right? And they didn't know what else to do.
Essentially, what you're kind of being a hatchet man for Cuccinelli.
Yeah, that was my job. Yeah. Not kind of. Not. Yeah, that's exactly what my job was.
This is an interesting thing to me. So I took a plane from I went to Norman Lear's 100th birthday party thing out in L.A. And I'm taking a trip back to New York. And I'm sitting with a guy who was in radio, and he did Hannity, and he did Rush, and did that kind of stuff. He's a Republican. And we got along. We got along, you know, and he wasn't politically with them that much. He was more just a Republican. But we're in the car back. He gives me a ride back to Manhattan.
You really bonded on this plane flight.
We really did. He offered me this ride. It was, I'm a friendly guy. So anyway, so he has a driver who's from Poland. So I, of course, ask him, like, where in Poland he's from? Are there Ukrainian refugees there? That kind of thing. And then we start talking about Tucker Carlson and him saying, like, Democrats tell us we should hate Putin, but why? And this is like the day before they invaded. And he says, well, he gets a lot of listeners or a lot of viewers. And I go, yeah, but it's evil. And he goes, well, you got to make money. And I'm going, like, really? Really? Really?
Yeah.
Do you have to sell yourself so short that I'm going to do shit in order to make a living? Are you that untalented? Are you that sad?
And the answer to a lot of this, actually, Al, is that they're just not, they're not that courageous, and they don't have the creativity and willingness to say, you know what, I can do something better with my life. And like, this is what I found, is that a lot
there's
of it
so
is
much
more about
better
inertia.
Stuff to do.
Yeah. And especially the types of people that we're talking about, the people that I interview in this book, the people that are elite Republican political consultants at the top of their game, making lots, everybody is well into the six figures that I interviewed for this book. All of them are college graduates and smart. I would say this to them. I was like, there are plenty of other things you could do. You know, there's no shortage of job availability for that. It's different if you're the bottom person on the totem pole at an oil company and there's a spill, right? And it's like, you got to put food on the table of your family. Like, you have a lot more empathy for people like that who are maybe don't feel great about their job, but like absolutely need it. That is not any of the people in Washington. Like, Washington offers a plethora of opportunities for people, maybe not to make the same amount of money. You know, one of the quotes that I found most interesting. It was on background in the book from a friend of mine, because I did some of these interviews before I knew it was going to be a book. And so I wanted to respect that it was on background. But he said, you know, this guy that used to be the head of the chief of staff of the RNC, Mike Shields, that I write about, who I knew Trump was terrible, had said it to me, had said it to other people in private, mutual friends. Like, why did he go along to team up with Donald Trump's campaign manager, Brad Parscale, on like a consulting firm to make all this money? Why did he do that? He could have made money another way. The guy said, well, I don't know. He'd never been in a job where he'd made more than $250,000 a year before Trump won. And this was his moment to really make big bucks. I was like, only $250,000? I mean, you can do pretty good on $250,000 still, right? There are plenty of opportunities for people like that. So some of this is greed, but some of it is also just this inertia, and you have to summon the will within you to say, you know what? I can try something new. I can succeed at something new. I can change horses in the middle of my life. And a lot of people just didn't have the balls for that, really.
And you did that.
Yeah, I did. I kind of fell into it. I don't want to turn this into Chris Christie's podcast where I talk about how great I am, but I did that in 2016. Part of it was because I really thought it was crazy to think that Trump could possibly win, and he was also awful. And so to me, it was like doing the right thing and my career both lined up. You know, I signed up to stop this buffoon from becoming the president, and then he becomes the president. And so, you know, I go into a career crisis where I felt like, you know, I needed to do something different. And I weighed everything. Part of me is like, maybe I should just go do PR for a pillow company. No, not my pillow, but, you know, a Clorox company, right? Like, maybe I should just go do PR for some harmless company 9 to 5 and parent my child and coach the basketball team and whatever. Just quit this shit. But I was like, I felt like if he was going to run again, I still wanted to kind of finish the job and decided to stay in, and luckily met with Bill Kristol and worked and figured that out. So, but my example is just demonstrates that, like, there's a whole range of options during the Trump era for people besides becoming a Never Trumper on MSNBC or going to work for Donald Trump. Right. My old colleague, Sally Bradshaw, who was Jeb Bush's top advisor in Florida, she said, screw it. She opened a bookstore in Tallahassee and said, I'm going to go live my life and do something different. And you know, you could work for a nonprofit. You could just work for some company, right? Like, there are a million things to do, but this allure of DC, the allure of being in the mix, like that part of it, this fact that you feel like you're on this team and you should see it out, all of that becomes much more powerful than I think I anticipated it being. I wasn't that surprised that the voters went for somebody like Trump, because we all saw this coming, as you brought up. But I was surprised that, like, literally 95% of these assholes all just went along with it, too.
Yeah. And that's how really, really bad things happen. For example, just the cruelty of that administration. So the separation of families at the border. Unbelievable.
Did you read that Atlantic story about the separation?
I have, yeah.
It is so good. And I thought it was a companion kind of from the administrative state to my book. Like, my book is all about the political hacks. But
we should tell people what this is. It's an article in the Atlantic Monthly about just how this happened, the history of the separation of the kids. And it's really just horrible.
Extremely well reported. But the interesting thing about this is interviewing all the people that worked at DHS and all these various places. And there were really only three acutely evil people pushing for this. It was Stephen Miller, Jeff Sessions, and another top person for working for Sessions in DHS. Everybody else, even up to John Kelly and Kristi Nielsen, who I find terrible, were at some level like trying to resist it or delay, you know, stall or delay it, right? And then there are all these administrative people up and down the line, even some white hats, some good actors, who did things that turned out to be bad because they didn't leak, for example, like the list of where all the kids had been. They'd kept an Excel sheet and they didn't leak it to the media for a while because they were worried that if they did, then they would be outed, you know, and targeted, right? And so the big takeaway I have from the story is that across the entire government, you know, there are like three evil people who really want to push for a policy end like that can make it happen only with the assistance of hundreds of people who are just regular humans, right? With good impulses and negative impulses, trying to balance like their job and whether they should, you know, whether it's worth quitting over this, and inertia kind of pushing them along towards allowing this to happen. And I think that that is like an important encapsulation, really, of the entire Trump era. That, like, yes, there are sociopaths. Yes, there are bigots. Yes, there are people that want a Donald Trump autocracy. But like, they would have never been able to get even close to doing it if it wasn't for this other much larger class of people that rationalized their way into being participants.
And that's what your book is all about. And you, from very personal experience, talk about now, you even help in the confirmation process for Pruitt, who was pretty awful.
Pruitt, awful, the worst. yeah. So here I am now in it's in the winter of 2016, right? I'm like, my career is over. I'm getting targeted hate mail from all these Trumpers. Like, people are telling my business partners they should fire me. I was at a PR firm at the time. And, I'm in a dark place. I watched some movies about death over and over, over and over again. I get this call from Pruitt, who I'd known, from a past life, because he had endorsed Jeb. And he said, hey, and Pruitt had been an ever-Trumper. And he's like, hey, I want to be the EPA chief. Will you, like, help prep me for this and give me PR advice? And honestly, it was like just this lifeline of, I don't know what else to do. And this is what I've done all my life. And so, yeah. And so for a few weeks, I think it's important to understand, even though I hated Trump more than anybody, more than you, Al, I promise, like, I hated him. Like you get the wheels turning of your ego, right? And you start to say, okay, well, I know how to do this. I can help prep this guy. I can think about the hard questions he's going to get, all the staffer stuff. Mm-hmm. I can work the reporters for him. You start to feel, okay, I'm useful. Like, my life isn't over. My career isn't over. I can keep figuring out how to work in this world. And I did that for a little while. He gets confirmed. And then, turns into a monster. I guess he was always a monster.
He was kind of a monster. His record in Oklahoma was terrible.
Yeah, his record in Oklahoma was terrible. So obviously, again, should have seen it coming. Don't do your due diligence. But this is how you justify it. And then, a few months into the administration, I finally said to his chief of staff, like, I can't give this guy advice anymore. Like, I think he should quit. Meanwhile, he's angling to replace Sessions as the DOJ to run cover for Trump. Can you just imagine both the narcissism and the corruption to look at what was happening with Sessions and be like, now I want to get in to be attorney general to help kill the Russian investigation? And this is how debased this guy was. But yeah, I did help him and I get confirmed. I would have gotten confirmed without me, but I think that it's important to understand why I did that, which was just this compartmentalization and this career element of, like, you have to do it before I finally, it's like the mob, they try to pull you back in and you finally have to have the internal gumption to be like, no, this is over. It's finally over. And for me, it happened sadly, even after Trump was in there a little bit into 2017.
Well, that's what's really great about this book, which is how honest it is. And also, because it's honest, you actually learn something about human beings and how this happened, as opposed to Chris Christie's book.
I hear Jared Kushner's book is also super honest. A lot of self-reflection coming there.
He's so hard on himself. How I got that $2 billion from the Saudis. All we had to, I feel so terrible because my father-in-law gave them some top secret documents and I got the $2 billion. I feel terrible about that. I want to ask you, speaking of Pruitt, about environmental stuff, just because at one point you talk about the oppressive waters of the U.S. rule, which was dumb, I swear. This is what you say. Right? This is on page 104.
Okay. Wow. I have like 8 conservative policies that I just confirmed that I genuinely support throughout the book. And you've chosen the most obscure one to try to challenge me on. I'm ready.
Okay. The waters of the U.S. is basically, it's an EPA thing. And it says the EPA can regulate navigable waters that flow into other navigable waters, and controlling the pollution. Farm Bureau is against it, and it's a big issue for them because they want to run off their fertilizer into the body of water next to them, which flows into ultimately the Mississippi, which goes down to the Gulf of Mexico. And there's this huge dead zone there because of nitrogen. which is endangering the coast, and which actually makes New Orleans more vulnerable. This is an important rule.
I concur with you that there should be a clean water rule and that there should be some sort of jurisdiction over navigable waters. The WOTUS rule, which was controversial among the Farm Bureau and crowd, that was put in place during the Obama administration, like, expanded the definition of navigable waters significantly to include like random roadside ditches and, you know, little ponds that are on people's farmland, and, you know, just kind of expanded the fingers of the federal government beyond what was sensible and, you know, what helped our little family farmers, you know, give us the nutrients that we need. So that's all I was saying. It was just it was a little overreach. You can have good federal regulations that are well intended that go a little overboard and they can be reined back a little bit.
The EPA cut them an enormous amount of, and the DO and the Department of Agriculture cut farmers an amazing, listen, one out of six jobs in Minnesota is tied to agriculture. I'm very good friends with Kevin Papp, the head of the Farm Bureau. In my second race, they didn't endorse the Republican because I have such a good friend of theirs.
There you go. But you told them they were wrong on WOTUS?
Yeah. And they respected that. The first time I got the Friend of the Farmer Shield, which is you get presented, Kevin Papp gives me this, we're in my office taking a picture of him giving me this thing. I said, Kevin, this means a lot to me. And he says, it's just the way you voted. And so, which I thought was hilarious. And then I just gave him shit about that forever. And then we were really good friends.
Well, I think we can agree to disagree on the extent of the WOTUS regulations. I take your feedback. I'm happy to read any materials you'll provide. While we're on the environment thing, I do think that it's important to just mention, because this is something that you get a lot of times from, you know, when you hear the argument about, oh, I think the Republicans have always been evil and nothing ever changed. The environment is another area that I do care about. I'm from Colorado. I obviously believe in climate change. I think that there is a meaningful difference in McCain in 2008. The campaign platform for that Republican general election campaign was in support of cap and trade, right? And I think that there's good reason to believe that had McCain beaten Obama, he didn't even come close, that might have been the deal that he cut right away. And at the time, there was, again, there was a minority of Republicans within the Senate, but there were a minority, your old pal, Lindsey Graham, and mine, you know, who I've drank some Chardonnay with. But he would have supported that and some other people. And so I that is a meaningful difference to go from that period where there is a element within the Republican Party like me that think there should be conservation rules, that think we should address climate change, you know, doing so maybe sometimes differently than what the, you know, far left environmentalists would want to do, but wanting to work in good faith to do something versus what you have now, which is it's a litmus test now to pretend like climate change isn't even happening, right? Like there's just no element of this at all left within the party.
You know what changed all of it, of course, was Citizens United.
I think Citizens United was a big part of the change.
A huge part, because the Koch brothers bought the Republican Party.
I'm skeptical of that. Can I offer a different view? I do think that the Koch brothers' influence is noteworthy, particularly on policy issues. But I think you have to go back to your old Rush Limbaugh book, Al. I think that the source of this stuff is very much bottom up. And I think that if you use Donald Trump as the example in 2016, and he had no money, he spent no money, he ran no ads. Like what he did was channel the grievances and the conspiratorial mindset and the hatreds of the Republican base, that some of it that came naturally, and some of that was stoked by right-wing media. I remain pretty skeptical that like a bunch of TV ads ran by the Koch brothers. I think it can have an influence in local elections for sure. But that's, that like changes
local election
the views
means
of people.
Like for U.S. Senate.
Yeah,
what I'm talking about. I saw Jerry Moran back off on stuff because you're going to be primaried, and the Koch brothers are going to drop $10 million on you.
There were no successful primaries, though, run by the Koch brothers against people based on climate stuff.
But Jerry backed off.
Yeah. I mean, was Jerry backing off because of the Koch brothers, or did Jerry back off because every time he went and had a little town hall in Topeka, you know, everybody there was talking to him about how climate change is a myth and George Soros is funding everything on the left, and that, you know, if he doesn't go along with every conspiracy, they're going to find Chris Kobach to beat him. And it's a chicken and egg element, but I think that's kind of where I land.
But, you know, Trump didn't have to run ads because he had 1.5 hour ads on CNN constantly.
That didn't hurt.
Right?
It certainly didn't hurt. I remember I don't think I've included this in the book. I had a screaming match with Zucker and some other people at the head of CNN during the campaign. Well, it does nothing, but just to show you, like, our position, not that Jeb is perfect or great or whatever, but we had one of our research nerds do an analysis, and CNN, Of the times that Jeb Bush got mentioned on CNN, it was like 80% or 70% in relation to responding to what Trump had said. Yeah, it was like 70% response to what Trump had said, 20% polling, you know, 8% gaffes, random gaffes he had on the campaign trail, and like 2%, you know, one mention of anything else that we did. It was just like totally enveloped the entire race. So it wasn't even just the speeches, right? It was the fact that the news cycle just was totally dominated by whatever he had farted out on Twitter,
carrying him constantly. And what was interesting, and I just did a podcast, just recorded one with Sarah Silverman, and we were just talking about how Trump is a good stand-up comedian. Yeah. He's a guy who has no actual real good, no sense of humor, and doesn't ever laugh, but he riffs, and he can talk forever. And that's a talent. That's why Zucker ran it. I remember I was campaigning for Hillary during the thing, and she said that she and Huma, when they're on the road, would want to watch it because it was so entertaining. They'd want to watch.
That's
Trump.
Disturbing. He never clicked for me. I don't know what that is, but I get that some people
fascinating.
Happened for me. I mean, I guess it was kind of fascinating, right? That a major party nominee would just be up there, like talking about like random TV celebrities, Botox regiments or like whatever. Like that was not normal. But it wasn't interesting to me. But he was good at the crowd. The crowd part of it is also a massive key to his success that people underestimate, which is why he keeps doing those rallies. Part of it is his ego. But the other part is he needs to hear what the people want, because he doesn't believe any of this shit, or he doesn't believe anything. He's a total nihilist, and he just cares about Donald Trump, you know, people liking him.
And so he's riffing and listening and listening to what worked. And that's right. Why, you know,
the Muslim ban happened. Honestly,
Build the Wall happened.
Yeah. If the crowd was cheering for, like, work with the Democrats on bipartisan solutions to get things done, that's what Donald Trump would have done, right? It's not like he had this deep ideology that pushed him to this, but that is part of the bottom-up element.
He had some instincts.
He did.
He had some real instincts about hating foreigners, about, you know what he had an instinct for, and you were working with Jeb, and he had an instinct, and he was, I think, the only candidate in it who attacked W for Iraq and just for 9/11. I remember when Jeb in a debate said, "Don't you remember my brother standing on the rubble?" I remember when he said, "Standing on the rubble." That's your
yeah, not
with the bullhorn. Well, your brother was standing on the fucking rubble.
Yeah.
The Clinton administration told you guys that bin Laden was the number one threat, and you ignored that. And then in South Carolina, which is a state with huge military, you know, retirees, et cetera, and bases, he just goes out in that debate and says the war in Iraq was a terrible mistake. And not one other of the Republican candidates would ever say anything like that. And the response was, yeah.
Yeah. You're absolutely right about that. And he even dabbled, went so far in that South Carolina to kind of dabble in some 9/11 conspiracy. And it was like Trump in word salad. So, you know, there was like some, depending on how you interpreted it, there could have been a little inside job accusation at Jeb there.
Jesus Christ.
But yeah, and crazy stuff. So it combines this kind of crazy stuff with having that reptilian instinct you talked about where people were on this. And I think that it's another huge mistake. I wrote about that 2012 autopsy that we talked about. And I was like, you know, had a responsible conservative populist in 2016 or in 2012 run against Romney or in 2016 that said, okay, let's review kind of some of the orthodoxies around these forever wars. You know, let's like take a look at how we can revitalize manufacturing rural America. It's a counterfactual. I don't know, but like maybe something like that could have landed because you were right. He was where the base was on that. He knew it, I think, partially because of being, you know, his own instincts, but partially because he's out there, you know, talking to these voters. And it was a canary in the coal mine for me. One of my Trumpy uncles, you know, said to me before when I took the Jeb job, he was like, he has to go out against the war. He's like, the people are mad about the wars. And kind of in this political class bubble, Republican bubble, you know, that was not shared because not most of us, you know, didn't deal with the sacrifices of the war, to be honest. We were protected from it. And so didn't feel the kind of anger that was out there, even among Republican voters personally. And I think that he channeled that. And that was absolutely right. And just one other thing on this, which goes to, you know, show that maybe something possibly could have happened within the Republican Party that would have pivoted to a good place, is if you look at the 2016 election, a lot of voters looked at Trump and thought he was the moderate option over Hillary because he had the heterodox views on Iraq and on Social Security. And so, you know, while those of us in the establishment were pushing, you know, moderation on immigration and climate, where people didn't agree with us, conceivably, I think a more responsible person could have turned the party a little bit more on economic and foreign policy issues while remaining culturally conservative. That wouldn't have been a party that appealed to me at all, but it would have been a better place to land. And I think that's the only hope for the Republican Party is to land someplace like that, because it's never going back to McCainism.
I just think that the Republican Party has ceased to be a party that participates in good faith in democracy. I'm very frightened.
I agree that that's the more likely outcome. I just mean that when people ask me what's a hope, that my book offers no hope, right? It's a very bleak book. Like, usually these books have a last chapter that's like, and here's how the Republican Party gets better.
Well, chapters are always pathetic.
Yeah, so I don't have that in my book. I told my editor, I was like, this isn't one of those books. But I think that, yeah, I agree with you. Right now, it's just a totally nihilist, anti-democratic, owning the libs. That's all that drives it. But I just mean, for any hope to come, the people that are trying to change the party are all trying to make it like go back to George H.W. Bush. And like George H.W. Bush is never walking through that door again. You know, like if the party's going to come back, it will have to be this kind of Boris Johnsonism, you know, sort of a little more economically moderating and anti-globalist, which isn't a great party for me, but whatever. Like that's the only kind of path.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Tim Miller.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, services, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
And we're back with Tim Miller. Trump tapped into resentment.
Yes.
And resentment that's real. You know, if you're from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and you go to Washington, D.C., and you look around and you see these beautiful hotels and restaurants and obviously the government buildings, but just the affluence there. And you say, this isn't happening in Wilkes-Barre. And so when they talk about elites, they're talking about the Washington political class, the self-serving Washington political class. And so that resentment is what Trump tapped into. Then, of course, when he was there, he fed that class. And, you know.
Here's the scary and sad part about all this, Al, and this isn't part of what this is now up to present day, but like, in theory, there could have been some responsible Republican leaders that actually wanted to address that resentment. But like, that's not what's happening. That's not what Donald Trump is. Like, these people, Steve Bannon, none of them, they don't care about these people. It's all a con. You know, the anti-vax thing is a con. The election fraud thing is a con. So instead of actually trying to address the Wilkes-Barre, you know, person's legitimate resentment and make their lives better, the Republican Party now is just, you know, feeding them a load of bullshit about election fraud, hysteria, and, you know, whatever the latest, you know, conspiracy is, whatever the latest concern is about, you know, the next caravan. You would hope that the Democrats could be able to take advantage of that to go into some of these places. And, you know, maybe that's the Fetterman model. I don't know. But like, that is the part that's the scariest about all this, is they're just radicalizing all these people further, you know, by giving them new resentments rather than trying to address, you know, I think some legitimate grievances.
You know, and the source, I'm reading a book now about college and where we went wrong. And where we started going wrong was Ronald Reagan exploiting what happened at Berkeley to start charging more and more tuition. Kids, these kids are getting a free ride. You know, the best thing that happened to us was the GI Bill and all these guys being able to go to college and expanding college. And of course, that was basically white guys who fought, right? What happened was
not entirely,
but mainly.
Yeah.
I mean, 90%, 95%. I mean, that was just the case. And that's why all the executives, et cetera. And I remember right after that people were criticizing that the GI Bill, saying like, oh, you're going to have a lot of hillbillies going to college. Well, they did. And they became executives of big companies. and it was great. And then at a certain point, you know, Reagan ran against Berkeley to become governor, and they started raising tuitions. And that's why we have all this debt. And that has fucking killed the very people who have all this resentment now.
Yeah, we could do a whole hour on the count. I mean, the anti-elite element has certainly been there since Reagan and is certainly BS and is on hyperdrive right now. I don't think that the elites have frankly helped by continuing to pump student loans, like pump free money student loans, and let these colleges feel like they can like build all these buildings and hire all these administrators and do everything because they'll eventually get bailed out. I don't know if that really helped either, nor the cloistered coastal elites I think have separated themselves from what's happening in a lot of parts of the country, not just the white working class, but the black and Hispanic working class. So, I think that there's problems to, you know, that there's blame to go around on that front. But certainly now, you know, we're at this place where that's very potent, and that the Republican Party is almost entirely animated by channeling those grievances.
Yep. Well, let's see. When I you're gay.
I am gay. I mentioned that in passing earlier.
Okay. But you know, there was you were working for Republicans who were just against.
We're going back to me being terrible. Got it.
Oh yeah, we had to circle back. Okay. No, but I mean that was you know, a conflict for you, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was the most embarrassing part to both write about and to just go back and relive. I felt like I had to do it again so that I could.
Again, this is an unbelievably honest book.
Yeah, I had to do it both so I could understand, because I hoped that it would help the reader understand why, you know, people continue to go along with Trump. And I hope that it gave me some credibility when I started, you know, taking out the bazooka to my old colleagues that, you know, that the reader would know that I was, I meant it, and that I wasn't just, you know, kind of full of shit. But yeah, I mean, the one example I think is the starkest that I went back. I had an interview with the Advocate magazine in 2009, I guess. It was after the McCain campaign. And at that time, I was like, I guess the most prominent out Republican, who is still in politics. Melman had come out, but like there just weren't really. There were a lot of Republicans in Washington who are gay, who like worked in, you know, policy jobs or behind the scenes jobs. It was like a spokesperson, and so she just interviewed me about like how I dealt with this. And I went back and read the interview, and she asked me about when McCain had slipped. You might remember this in, I guess, 07. He had slipped in a hardball interview and said that, yeah, whatever. If they want to have a private ceremony, that's fine. And and his consultant comes during the commercial break, comes off from off stage, and it's like, Senator, I think you just kind of endorsed gay marriage. You're running in a Republican primary. And he had to backtrack and say, well, you know, I mean, it's private. We shouldn't acknowledge it through the laws. And he corrected himself. Mm-hmm. She asked me how I felt when that happened. And I told her in this interview, I said, I was mad at him for screwing up, because I was working for him and I wanted him to win. And I was mad, and that was an untenable position. And I just rereading that interview, I just like how embarrassing is that? But how great of an insight is it into the warped kind of mindset?
It was truthful.
Yeah. Of somebody in politics like that. I was being truthful to that interviewer then. And I should have been embarrassed about it. I wasn't then, but I am now. But it's like that is this mindset you get into if you are, you know, so focused on winning and so committed to the game of politics. And that is what is animating you. And that's what's getting you excited. Then, you know, it's easy to rationalize this stuff. You're just like, well, we got to do what we got to do to win. Like, we got to run these crazy ads about the caravans coming in, or, you know, we got to put on our red Donald Trump hat and do the build the wall Legos, because that's what the primary voters want.
You know, it's funny. In 2007, when I announced I was going to run for the Senate, so I had some supporters come to my house to tell them I was going to do this. And there was this gay couple. The guy who was very politically active said to me, just don't say you're for a same-sex marriage.
That was advice.
That was his advice. And I said, but I'm for it. And he said, well, okay, well, don't say it. And I said, if I'm asked about it, I'm going to say I am, because I am. And I was the first Senate candidate to come out for that. Because I was for it.
Well, I appreciate your leadership in that. Honestly, that might have sounded sarcastic, but I meant it sincerely. I really do.
Minnesota.
Yeah, and I do think that we, you know, and that's actually, that's what was part of my rationalization. And I'm not endorsing this at the time, by the way, but you know, I'm out there going, well, Obama's out there, you know, kind of dancing around on this. So why should I feel bad myself? Right. But if everyone makes that rationalization, if everyone's like, well, I'm just one cog in here, why should I care? I should try to win. Then, you know, you end up with a result that like we did with Trump. And so I think in retrospect, frankly, Obama could have been for gay marriage in 2008 and would have won anyway. I mean, he crushed John McCain, right? So like, and he obviously was for it. It's like this notion that was, even at the time, you know, that was political strategists like being overly cautious and caring more about the game. And as you know, obviously you became a senator, so that you bucked that advice and demonstrated that it was okay. And I think that we'll never know for sure, but I think that Obama could have done it in 2008.
Well, we made a lot of progress there, and But Clarence Thomas wants to revisit it.
He does. And it'll be interesting to see whether there can be 10 Republican votes for it would be, I guess, codifying the DOMA repeal, not the Obergefell, but still it'd be something. And I hope that the Democrats make them vote on it, even if there isn't.
Well, 10. Tammy Baldwin has put a bill out.
Yeah, she has. That. And there have been, I guess, four. There were originally five Republicans who said they were for it, and then Ron John backed off. He's taking the rare backwards flip-flop on gay marriage, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. Ron Johnson said he'd be for Tammy's bill and then got a little pressure, I don't know, or whatever, and he recently backtracked. So now Ron Johnson has a rare distinction of being of the year 2022 reverting to becoming anti-gay marriage.
He's amazing, isn't he?
Yes, and I think Mandela should run on that, by the way. I think Democrats have been, there are certain social issues the Democrats candidates should maybe still be scared of, or at least scared of going, you know, too far overboard and turning off some voters. But I think that, obviously, gay marriage, I think things like that 21-year gun, you know, age limit, I think that on abortion, of course, I think that this is maybe a first moment in a while where some of these Democratic candidates should feel like they should be prosecuting this case against Republicans instead of scared of it.
You know, when Clarence Thomas put out his opinion, he said that they should revisit Obergefell, right, and Casey, right?
Yeah.
And so I immediately said, called for us to put on the floor bills saying everyone has the right to use contraception and the same-sex marriages are the right of people. And I did call Tammy. And she put that on the floor.
Smart. And I think that it's obviously a winner to campaign on.
Yeah, I love that Johnson is flip-flop. That's great. Boy, we got to beat him. You know what his two most important words in his business career were? I do. His father-in-law.
Oh, got it.
Put him in the business.
Got it. Yeah, well, you know, up from his bootstraps. His father-in-law carried him up from his bootstraps.
I'm going to Wisconsin in a couple weeks.
Did you, sir? I think Mandela is a really impressive guy, Mandela, yep. Barnes, who's running against him. And, you know, the Republicans are going to...
Nelson Mandela.
Also impressive. That's
very
bold,
impressive.
Bold statement from me. I'm sure that he would appreciate my endorsement.
Very impressive.
Especially after talking about all my failings. But no, Mandela Barnes. And I think that a lot of folks have said that that's not winnable. And I disagree with that. I Mandela is a little bit more, I think, progressive than some of the other candidates have run there. But he's a smart guy. And so I'm glad you're going there to campaign. And I think that there are ways, with maybe out going overboard on some of the stuff that's hurt Democrats, like the defund the police thing, which I don't think was particularly helpful, but there are ways to do
that was
to hit on some of these.
Insane to say that, right?
Yeah. So, but there are ways to hit on these cultural issues, like the gay marriage. Even in Wisconsin, you know, in Wisconsin, being against gay marriage is putting you on the negative side of the ledger with the median voter. And so I think that that's conceivably a winnable one.
I really, really, really enjoyed the book. It was very funny. So
high praise.
Yeah, from me, goddamn.
Coming from a pro.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Yeah, not as funny as my books.
Yeah, sure. You know, but I'm trying. I'm an amateur.
That's right. No,
maybe we can do a little routine. You know, take it on the road.
No.
Not quite.
I don't
not quite that funny.
I don't work with gay people.
Okay. But what if I'm the straight man?
Oh, that's a thing. See? That's funny.
Could be a bit there.
There. I'll be the straight man. I'm the straight man. You're the gay man. And now we've got an act. I'm working on it.
Okay. Oh.
When I flesh it out, you okay. Know. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you, like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.